9:30. We will get started with first checking to see who is on the phone with us this morning. Dusty Johnson, are you there?
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Congratulations. How's Benjamin doing?
Oh, he's great. He's great.
We're picturing you sitting there with droopy eyes and T-shirt on, holding on to your new edition. Congratulations.
Well, I would say that if I'm quiet for too long, you may want to wake me as I might have drowsed off.
Drowsed off, rather. Mark Anderson, are you there? Mark Anderson?
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Wilcox?
Here, Mr. Chairman.
And Sandy Johnson, are you there?
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Jeff Decker?
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Christy McDermott?
Present.
Colleen Savold? Oh, that's right. We have Colleen, Jason, and Chris from Quest who are going to stand by. So once your item is taken care of, if you would drop off, we have a number of, we do not have enough lines to facilitate everyone who wishes to participate today. So we need to open up on the bridge as we go along here. We'll appreciate your cooperation there. Christy Lyngstad and Bill Heaston.
It's Bill Heaston, Mr. Chairman. I'm here.
Tal Wysorek.
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Larry Thompson and Doug Idle.
Present.
Kathy McGinn.
Present.
Dennis Duncan. Sean Simpson.
Here, Your Honor.
Sean, we hear you loud and clear. Mary Sizek?
Present.
Did I even get close to your name that time?
Sisak.
Sisak. Well, I want it to be a long I. Welcome. Glad all of you could join us. We have a number of people who are also with us today here in Pierre. This is the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission regular meeting of March 25, 2008. It's 9:30 a.m. at the State Capitol Building in room 468. With me today is Commissioner Steve Kolbeck. My name is Gary Hansen, and on the line is Commissioner Dusty Johnson. First item on the agenda today is Consumer Reports by Deb Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. The Commission has received a total of 63 contacts since the last report was prepared for the March 11, 2008 Commission meeting. 9 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 11 of the contacts involved electric services, 8 contacts involved natural gas service, 6 contacts involved cell phone service, 16 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 2 contacts involved the Grain Warehouse Division, and 11 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 494 of the 561 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved, and 2,287 of the 2,337 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved.
Thank you, Deb. Are there any questions on the consumer report? If not, before we get into electricity, I would just like to say that Mr. Miller, Bob Miller's very last day at the PUC, and we will be partying afterwards for the sake of not seeing Bob any longer coming up here. I assume that you'll be able to, in all seriousness, Bob, we really appreciate everything that you've done from a standpoint of facilitating information with PUC over probably a much longer period of time than any of us can recall. How long has it been? 17 years. Well, thank you for your service, and we appreciate, like I say, you being a conduit of information for the Public Utilities Commission over that period of time. So thank you. Are you going to be testifying on anything today?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. I intend...
Well, it looks like you will be testifying.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. I am Bob Miller, and it really, other than to say thank you everyone for being so kind to me over the years and to tell you that I really do intend to occasionally show up to, as an irate consumer, to see if I can't help make your commission meetings a little longer and file a few more docket items for you. But other than that, you won't see too much of me.
Well, we'll call the Alzheimer's Institute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. First item on the electricity agenda is EL05-023 in the matter of the application of Xcel Energy for a construction permit to build 9.6 miles of the Split Rock to Lakefield Junction 345 kV transmission line and add facilities to the Split Rock substation. We have both the party of Xcel as well as the property owner on the line with us today. And March 11th at the regular commission meeting, the commission decided not to permit the line to be energized pending further action, and a follow-up mailing was required to be done to landowners. We wanted to determine the extent of the deficiency in communication to landowners, if there was one. Also, to obtain and present to the commission and a landowner, Ms. Johnson, more precise information concerning the location of a structure. I believe it was 35, although there was discussion on another pole, and XL's easement in that area. And we appreciate the information that's been sent to the commission during that period of time. Mr. Gertis, are you here to represent any of the parties?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pier, and I represent XL Energy. As you know from the introductions, Mr. Chairman, Jim Wilcox, the manager of government and regulatory affairs for XL Energy, as well as Mark Anderson, the project manager for this project for XL, are on the line and will serve as resources. May I proceed? As the commission knows, at the last meeting, there were some misunderstandings about some of the aspects of the project, and XL has endeavored to set the record straight and to clarify any misconceptions that may have existed as to the status of this project. I do need to emphasize, Mr. Chairman, that it is important to XL Energy and to their customers and those who wish to see wind power on the transmission lines that these lines, if at all possible, be energized today or after this meeting. As you will recall, Mr. Chairman, the commission requested more information as to the location of the various poles and other landmarks in this in the area that was in question. And Mr. Wilcox did file with the commission a letter dated March 21st, 2008, in which he dealt with several of these issues. First of all, of course, XL Energy engaged Sarah and Associates surveyors. They prepared three plat maps that are two scale and that are that depict the locations of the poles, the fence, the center line, and other items in that location. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, rather than just going on with the narrative, I think at this point I'd like to see if the commission has any questions, and either I or Mr. Wilcox or Mr. Anderson might answer them as it relates to these plats that were prepared.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gertis. The information that the, speaking for myself, the information that was presented to the commission from Sarah and Associates through XL Energy clearly does show the location of the poles that were in question, and clearly shows that pole 35 is in the very center of, or within approximately a foot or two of the center of section 25, and there had been some question at just which section it was in, and the surveys show precisely the location, so we appreciate that. We assume that the landowner can picture that as well. Are there any questions, first of all, from the other commissioners on XL, and then we'll turn to the property owner, see if there's any questions.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, it doesn't, just to break in, it doesn't show this on this plat, but actually section location, this is in the center of the section, this location. So, I mean, you're a long ways from either of the bordering sections on either side. This is the center of the section, but in any event. But it is, but what the map does show you is that pole number 35 is clearly on the west side of the line by about a foot and a half, and so there's no encroachment.
Correct. There was some, the reason I had brought it up was there was some question during the discussion at the last meeting as to whether or not it was in section 25 or in section, I forget what the other section was at this time, that either the landowner, property owner, or I think even someone from Excel was debating its location. So this survey clearly shows that it's within a foot or two of the exact center of the of section 25.
And
it relieves that question. It's clear to everyone now where the location is. Do any of the commissioners have any questions? If not, Ms. Johnson, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. I want to know, I have not seen the map from Sarah and Associates. So the map I have is the one I requested, and Mr. Wilcox sent it to me, and I don't have a clue. It is in Section 25, according to the map I have right here in front of me, which is the map that I gave the number for at the last hearing. And but where the pole is 51 feet, 6 inches from the fence line to the north. Okay.
Are you referring to pole 35?
No. I'm referring to structure 35, correct. Okay. Now, on the map I have, they have it right on the fence line here. This is the map I requested. On your map, where is the pole? Where is the structure located?
So, Mr. Wilcox, are you on the line?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Has Excel provided a copy of the survey to Ms. Johnson?
No, I did not, Mr. Chairman. I provided the map that Ms. Johnson had asked me to provide here at the commission meeting 2 weeks ago. But
that's correct. But I don't have the survey map. So in proximity to where this structure is, the map I have, the structure is on the fence line. The structure is not on the fence line. I would like an updated map of this structure and show the location of it. And if they surveyed that and showed it, I don't have that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I certainly can provide Ms. Johnson with a copy of this Sayer map. No problem there.
It is a survey, and I would appreciate very much if you'd provide the three of them that we have, if you would provide those to Ms. Johnson as well. That clearly depicts the location of everything. It shows the distances. Can be used legally. It's an instrument that would be extremely beneficial to her. I know that you go to a significant expense for that, but if you would do that as a favor to the commission, we'd appreciate it.
Sure.
And with that, are there any other questions? Ms. Johnson, did you have anything else on this item?
No, I didn't, and I did receive my pack by certified mail of the commission's plan that was dated December 3rd, 2007, from Excel Energy with Pam Rasmussen signing off on this, and this came from Mr. Wilcox. And they said that they mailed them out again because they neglected to put in the PUC's address and phone number on the cover page.
Correct, and we received a copy of that as well.
Yes.
Thank you.
I have one other thing.
All right.
When I received the maps from Mr. Wilcox, he mailed me two of them and with the numbers on, the ones that the Burns McDowell's Todd Hunt had, okay? But he said at that time they talked access to construction area. Mr. Wilcox did in this letter to me. We have had no talk with access to any of our property any time during this project with Excel or Burns McDowell. So I don't know where he got that information, if Mr. Todd Hunt told him that or not. I do not have any. We have never talked to them about access to our property except in the easements, when the easement person came to see us. That's the only time we ever talked to access.
Right.
So I don't know who told him that, but that's not true.
Thank you. Excel or Mr. Curtis, do you have anything further to add for us?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, there were a number of other items at the commission's meeting that were discussed, and to the extent that they're relevant here, I guess I'll just mention them. Secondly, there were some questions about site restoration, and if you'll note in Mr. Wilcox's March 21st, 2008 letter on site restoration, he quotes the provisions of the easement, and of course Excel intends to do what the easement says, and that is to restore the area of the easement where construction has occurred to its prior condition, as well as can be done. And so that also is information that was provided to the commission pursuant to what we understood the commission wanted. And then finally, and it's been covered, but the verification packet was mailed out to everybody on the list. And I should note, Mr. Chairman, that Excel's proof that it was mailed the first time is, in fact, the list. And they believe that everyone that was on the list, which includes the Johnsons, got it the first time. Now, everybody knows that things get lost in the mail sometimes, but from Excel's standpoint, they got it into the mail. Now, it may not have gotten to the Johnsons, but Excel believes that it was put in the mail. And, of course, now the second time we mailed Excel mailed everything out again, and that included the full packet that everybody got before, plus the oversight was the commission's address and telephone number, and that has been provided to all the landowners. So, again, Mr. Chairman, as it relates to easement issues, if, in fact, the Johnsons do have issues with the easement or the cleanup or anything like that, we believe that their recourse lies with their easement and not here at the commission. And so we believe that Excel has satisfied their burden and that the commission's order that was previously entered withholding permission to energize the line should be corrected by an order correcting it issued by the commission pursuant to this meeting.
Thank you. Yes. The site restoration easement from Excel does state that Excel, or it states that the company, agrees that all earth or other materials necessarily excavated shall be separated and replaced so that the topsoil is replaced last so as to return crop production as soon as possible. It also states that NSP shall have the responsibility to remove or otherwise dispose of materials as a result of the construction, maintenance, or repair so as to return the area within the easement as nearly as possible to its original condition to preserve long-term crop production. Goes on to state a number of other items pertaining to construction and maintenance of the lines to protect the facilities. Are there any questions from the commissioner? Mr. Colbeck, Mr. Johnson? Excuse me, Commissioner Johnson or Commissioner Colbeck?
No, sir, thank you.
If not, the commission at its March 11th meeting granted the request of Excel to move the structure, but we did not grant permission to energize the line. At this time, I will make the motion to, excuse me, Ms. Knadel.
Thank you, Commissioner Hansen. This is Bob Knadel from Commission staff. I did try to contact 7 landowners that were on Excel's list. There was approximately 43 of them. 3 of them said they got the packet that was mailed on December 3rd. 2 of them said they didn't get the packet. 1 of them couldn't say one way or the other, and then 1 landowner didn't get back to me. So this would indicate that, in fact, the company did make a mailing on December 3rd. I thought you'd like to know that information. Thank you.
Not only would I like to have that information, but I appreciate your interrupting me and catching my attention so that we could have that. I do very much appreciate you keeping me on task so that we have that information as part of the record. Thank you very much. I will at this time make a motion that the commission give permission to energize the line in question on EL05-023. Is there any discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hanson votes yes. The motion carries. Item number 2 is EL08-003 in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation in business as Northwestern Energy for approval of a contract with deviations with Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railroad. The question today is, shall the commission approve the contract with deviations? Whom shall I start with?
Good morning, commissioners. This is Jeff Decker. The phones are kind of beeping in and out here, so whenever you're ready, I can discuss this item.
Thank you, Jeff. Go right ahead.
Okay. Burlington Northern is going to be putting in some track heaters on their line, and in order to serve those track heaters, Northwestern needs to spend approximately $9,000 to provide the transformer and bore in about 825 feet of primary cable. These track heaters use very little energy, as they're really only needed when the tracks are wet and when the temperature is very cold, those two things in combination. So anticipating very little usage, the company would like to charge Burlington Northern for the cost of the installation.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on this item, staff?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Dave Jacobson from Commission staff. Because this facility is of significant cost, it's dedicated to only one customer and it will serve minimum load, we agree with the application by the company and would recommend approval.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Any questions by members of the commission? Forgive me if there is anyone else that wishes to testify on this item. Is there anyone? If not, commission questions? Is there a motion?
Chairman, I would move to approve the contract with deviations.
Thank you. Discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
I vote aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. Motion carries.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Telecommunications, TC06-184, in the matter of the filing by Long Lines Wireless, LLC, for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier. Question before the commission is, today shall the commission designate Long Lines Wireless, LLC, as an eligible telecommunications carrier? And on the phone with us today is Christy McDermott.
Yes. Would you like me to speak to this matter first?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Thank you, Commissioner. Long Lines Wireless has met all conditions set forth by the South Dakota PUC and the FCC for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier. Staff concurs that we have met the conditions, so at this time I respectfully request that the Commission grant our request.
Thank you much. I'm going to turn to staff. I'm not sure whether to go to Ms. Wiest, or are you the person who will present on this, or is there someone else?
I can ask some questions.
I
had some questions.
Yes, I had your memo, and I've almost, you can see there's a little trepidation on my part to even start on the questions at this point. I thought there was someone else from staff that would be addressing us first, either Mr. Best or Ms. Kramer. Are you?
This is Harlan Best of staff. Staff would renew its recommendation to grant the ETC to Long Lines Wireless.
Okay. Thank you very much. In that case, we will turn to counsel Ms. Wiest. There are a number of items that we have some concerns over, and I'm not sure just whether or not I wanted to proceed and go through every one of the items, or whether to simply ask a couple of questions right off the top. And I hate to have the commission spend so much time on this when it appears we're going to. Ms. McDermott,
is it better we handle the questions offline? And have everything answered before?
I think it probably would have been better at one point, but there seems to be a lot of questions on whether you're serving partials and whether you need to do a cream skimming analysis, whether there needs to be asking for redefinition of some items, and it seems to be a lot of those.
A cream skimming analysis was filed.
Well, I will ask then Ms. Weiss to begin.
Yeah, I won't go through everything. I just have a couple of... I'll just start with a few questions, and then depending on the answers to those, maybe I could just follow up with a letter with any details if I think we still need to do that. I don't think we need to go through everything. But I guess my first question is, when you said you had done a cream skimming analysis, and I'm probably just missing something, but when you're, like, example, to do a cream skimming analysis, you have to have it served to the unserved exchanges. And all I could see on your list was population density for areas that you intend to serve as opposed to areas you don't intend to serve. So where is the analysis at?
That is correct. The analysis that I submitted was just on areas we were planning to serve, not on areas that we're not asking for designation for.
Right, but under the rule, the public interest standard rule, a cream skimming analysis compares the population density of each wire center in which the applicant seeks designation against that of the wire centers in the study area in which the applicant does not seek designation. So what I need is I need the population density in a cream skimming analysis for all of those areas where you do not, where you're not serving the entire wire center.
It was my understanding you just needed the population densities for areas where we were seeking partial designation, and those are listed as well.
No, you have to have not served to served. All you have is the ones that you want to serve. Anyway, I can write all this up, but again, I don't think the cream skimming analysis is complete. And then my other question is for partials, then. I just needed more information on, you have listed a number of partials. Is it your intent then to serve those, the entire wire center through resale or some other means?
No, it's our intent to ask for partial designation for those wire centers because we only are going to serve where our FCC licenses allow us to serve.
Okay, but as I mentioned at the last meeting, our rule specifically requires you to serve entire
exchange unless
wire
we ask,
centers.
I thought unless we ask for redesignation of that wire center.
No. Again,
did the cream skimming analysis.
But you didn't do a cream skimming analysis because you don't have anything for unserved. Anyway, again, I don't want to waste everybody's time. I do have questions, and I think it would be much more helpful just for me to send a letter, put it in the docket, and respond to those. If
I think so as well, and I appreciate that because it would take a very long time to go through all of these items like that. Are there any questions by the commissioners at this juncture?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dusty Johnson. I might just give an example that I think might help.
Dusty, we're having just a smidgen of trouble hearing you.
How about I speak up? Is this any better?
That's a lot better. We don't want you to wake Ben.
I have example that might be helpful for Ms. McDermott in understanding what Ms. Weiss is saying. If you look on that Exhibit C, and if you look on the second page, there's a line for Santel Communications Cooperative, and it does list the population density of the area that Longline proposes to serve. But what it doesn't do is tell us what the population density of the entire wire center is. And that's the analysis that is required part as a part of the file. Did I get that right, Ms. Weiss?
Yes.
And then a question I would have, rather just a clarification. Ms. German, in your letter to the commission from last week, I think, you noted that in the previous filing, the range of your cell sites was listed as 20-mile radius, and then you corrected that to mean 20-mile circumference. I wonder if you didn't mean 20-mile diameter.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha. And I presume that was the case, and I just wanted to make sure because if it was drastically different than what we understood the existing technology was able to serve, then that's an educational opportunity for us as commissioners. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have right now.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And Ms. Weiss, we appreciate your putting together a letter with all of the concerns so that they have an opportunity to respond to those and work through those. With that, are there any other questions from the commissioners? On TC06-184, then, we will defer action on that item until we'll place it on the next commission meeting pending potential action, and the parties can certainly ask that it be removed from that and placed on some subsequent meeting. Telecommunications, TC07-082 is the next item up before the commission. In the matter of the filing by Quest Corporation, DIECA Communications Incorporated, doing business as Covad Communications Company and McLeod USA Telecommunications Services Incorporated, for their notice of stipulation regarding certain performance indicator definitions and Quest Performance Assurance Plan provisions, and joint motion to approve same on behalf of the stipulating parties. The question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the stipulation? Which party is up first here?
Chair, this is Jason Topp from Quest. I didn't announce because people were arguing at the time that I called in, but I'd be happy to address this.
We don't argue here. We just discuss items.
Yes, discuss. Excuse me. And I believe that Chris Viveros is on as well.
Yes, I am, and like you, there was conversation going on when I joined in.
And Chris is the one that can answer questions about these actual standards, but I can introduce the stipulation. We have had performance assurance plan in place for several years and reached a relatively complex negotiation with a large number of CLECs in an effort to resolve a number of issues and make a number of adjustments to the plan. We have reached agreement on that. We filed it last July, requesting approval from the commission, and now request that you do so. Not aware of any opposition to this, and if you have questions about the terms of the stipulation or the changes themselves, I would punt to Chris with respect to those.
Thank you very much, Mr. Topp. Mr. Viveros, do you have something to add?
No, I think Jason covered it.
Thank you. Harlan or Karen, who is?
This is Harlan Best, Commission staff. It's staff's opinion that the change has gone into effect by commissions not acting within, I believe it's 60-day criteria, and that since it has already gone into effect, that the commission may not have to necessarily issue an order, just that it has, make note that it has gone into effect.
Thank you, Mr. Best. Are there any questions by commissioners? If not, is there a motion?
Chairman, I might just ask Mr. Best's opinion. I mean,
hey, Dusty, we're still having a challenge hearing you.
Let me try this. Is this any better?
That is considerably better. But
I got rid of the hands-free headset. So,
all right.
So Mr. Best, are you recommending that the commission not take formal action and that the absence of action would essentially be our concurrence with what has already happened, or do you believe a commission order is still appropriate?
My opinion would be that the since it's already gone into effect, that's all the commissioners have to do is just note that it has gone into effect.
So would any formal commission action today be required? I mean, if I understand the filing right, we would need to take action to challenge what has already happened. But if we don't take that action, then you know, we're fine. I mean, do we even need a motion today if we don't have a problem with the stipulation?
If there is a problem with the stipulation, the statute allows the rules. I'm not sure which it is on the federal side, would allow the commission to reconsider at that point in time.
So let's presume for a minute that no one has any objection. Is the appropriate motion merely to close the docket?
Just one. Maybe I should just ask Quest a question first, because what Harlan said is right. The statute talks about it goes into effect automatically after 60 days, although I believe the state commission can disapprove it any time after that. Though I address this to Mr. Topp, it's my understanding from a discussion in a kind of a related docket last year that it's Quest's position that changes to the PAP are not in effect automatically due to changes in the PAP. So I guess my question would be, when would Quest believe that the commission should approve the stipulation due to that fact?
Yes, Jason Topp. And typically, and I was just looking through our South Dakota PAP, but often the PAPs have a distinction, which is kind of an odd one, between the PAP itself and performance measurements. The PIDs, and the PAPs sometimes have language restricting the ability to modify automatically. Now, in my quick look, I don't see that in the South Dakota PAP, and so it's possible that is not included there. But we certainly would appreciate if the commission is fine with the stipulation, and if the commission concludes that approval is not necessary, I think that we would greatly appreciate an affirmative decision from the commission reaching that conclusion as opposed to no action.
Jason, this is Chris, and I'd like to add something. I don't disagree with what you said at all, but the fact of the matter is that the ROC, on behalf of the Quest 14 states, got involved in this and actually requested that we not put the changes in effect.
I looked at your website last week, and you had the changes to, I believe you had the changes to the PIDs, and you had put those into effect, but I don't think you had put into effect the changes to the PAP, and I was just wondering if that was because hadn't been approved yet. And I believe that was your position in a different docket regarding level 3.
Yes.
And maybe you've changed your position, but I just listened to the recording of it last week. So
yes. It's my belief that approval is necessary. I am trying to find language in the PAP that so indicates, and I'm not finding it right now.
I think you're thinking of the language, Jason, in 16.1.
Okay. I think we're above and beyond. This is the chairman. Good morning. I don't think we need to get into a long dissertation and discussion any further on to whether or not it needs to be approved or should be approved. I don't believe there's an objection to the approval. We're just talking about semantics at this juncture. Do any of the commissioners oppose simply approving it? Then we don't have to worry about all this. I will make a motion then that we approve TC07-082, I believe is the. Is there any discussion on that? Hearing none. Commissioner Johnson.
I vote aye.
Commissioner Colbeck.
Aye.
Commissioner Hanson votes aye. Motion carries. TC07-104. And TC07-118 are similar. One is an ILEC, one is a CLEC. They deal with the rates. The first, and I believe we can take them together if that's appropriate.
It would be much appreciated, Mr. Chairman.
TC07-104, in the matter of the filing by Prairie Wave Community Telephone Incorporated for an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch access rates, is the matter on TC07-104. The question on that item, as well as TC07-118, is today, shall the commission allow AT&T to withdraw And shall the commission grant the exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates? TC07-118 is in the matter of the filing by Prairie Wave Telecommunications Incorporated for an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates, and that is item number 5 on today's agenda. Mr. Van Camp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, in conversations with staff, AT&T informed them that they were contemplating filing a motion to withdraw their interventions. We got put on the docket, but there was a written filing that was made last week, and it is part of the docket, I believe, at least as is filed. AT&T at this point would move to withdraw its interventions in both the dockets number TC07-104 and TC07-118, based in part on the modified or amended petitions of Prairie Wave. The written motions that were filed late last week by AT&T make it clear that AT&T withdraws under the assumption and the assertion of Prairie Wave and its petitions as amended, that this is a 3-year requested exemption pursuant to commission rules, which encompasses 07, 08, 09, but they will have to come back in 010, and they are subject to any changes in rulemaking docket 05-002, which has long been languishing, or any changes on how switch access rates are formulated at the FCC level. AT&T, of course, in its petition, wanted to take the opportunity to urge the commission to move forward with the rulemaking docket. And talking to Ms. Kramer, it's my understanding that additional filings will be made by some parties shortly. Hopefully at that point we'll be ready to proceed. And AT&T wanted to make clear in its filing at least that this motion to withdraw was case specific and not intended as any acquiescence to the current rulemaking model or in any way could be seen to limit its participation in the open rulemaking docket moving forward.
Thank you. Is there, Harlan, are you, Mr. Best, excuse me, you're taking over for Mr. Singer, and we sincerely appreciate that. We know your caseload is stacked on top of SACs, so do you have anything to add on this item?
On AT&T's withdrawal of intervention.
Yeah. No. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things, maybe just a couple of questions about the, are we to understand then, Mr. Van Camp, that, you know, it says, that there's a little bit of a disconnect in paragraphs 3 and 4 of the motion that the basic motion withdrawal, is that a conditional motion withdrawal? And are we to take these in the nature of conditions, despite they're not being precisely labeled as such?
I understand, and the term condition was something that fell out of a draft, and if you read the final paragraph where we request our prayer for relief, that we categorize them as statements of AT&T for the record.
Okay. And so you want to withdraw anyway?
We're going to withdraw based on the assumption at this point and the petitions of Prairie Wave that it's requesting a 3-year exemption, that it is not requesting as it initially had in, I think, 104 mm-hmm. for an open-ended exemption pending rule change in the open docket.
Okay. And just one last question, and this is a real nitpick one here, but just so we understand, and mm-hmm. on the 2010 date, is that are you talking January 1, or are we talking either the September 17th filing date in 2010, or I can't remember what the expiration date, my recollection is it occurred in December of 2007. I guess just a little clarification on that. Is that meant to refer to one of those dates, or is it just a more generalized thing that sometime along about when Prairie Wave would legally be required under our rule, if not waived, that's what you want to see?
I see your concern with the language in Section 1 of the petition, or the motion, excuse me, and in talking to staff, it's my understanding that pursuant to the expiration in 2010 they will have to file.
Okay, whenever we decide whether it be, and I'm not totally clear on whether that, the filing date September 17th.
Correct.
And I guess my gut assumption would be, because that would be then the tariff filing date, that would be the date, but it's at least arguable that it would be the original expiration date, I guess, too. But whatever that is, then that's the date we're talking
about. Whatever the date is under the current rules, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. I skipped over Prairie Wave on the basis that I assumed that Prairie Wave would not oppose AT&T's withdrawal. However, I should have asked at least Prairie Wave, do you have any comments on this?
This is Bill Houston, Mr. Chairman. Normally my knee-jerk reaction to AT&T is to object, but I will concur and agree to the withdrawal of the motion.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this item? If not, commissioners, do you have any questions? If not, is there a motion on TC07-104 and TC07-118?
In those packets, TC07, 104, and 108, I would...
118.
I'm sorry, 118. The commission allow AT&T to withdraw.
Any discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. Motion carries. On the question, shall the commission grant the exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch access rates? Trying to figure out if there's anything for us to pursue there at this time. Mr. Houston?
We filed consistent with the rules. Just to make it clear, when we file again in 2010, we would not file until after we could close the 2009 financial year, fiscal year, because we need to look at the using 2009 as the test year under the commission rules. We would need to, you know, review the financials in that year to see whether we would seek a further waiver or whether we would go ahead and file a cost study. So with that in mind, that would be sometime in mid-2010. That's when we would file again, and everybody understands that we would ask that we be given the waiver as applied for. We think we've complied with the rule in our filing.
Thank you. Staff, Harlan?
That's Harlan Best of staff. In docket TC07104, the analyst had sent out an email to the company requesting that the company provide support showing the current cost study would support a rate increase as opposed to a rate decrease, and that response has yet to be received. So staff would request that the commission, in effect, defer action on the second question in TC07104.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, this is Bill Houston. I thought that had been sent to you.
I have not seen it.
Okay, I was under the impression yesterday, and when I talked to you, I thought that I apologize. I will make sure that you get that today. I was told that went out last Friday.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Bess. And thank you again for taking on those other items from Keith. Appreciate that.
We still have 118 to deal with, Mr. Chairman.
Correct.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Thank you. In the case of TC07-104, the commission will defer action on that item until the next meeting. TC07-118, we have the commission, as I understand, the first motion, we allowed AT&T to withdraw. Question before us at this time is, shall the commission grant the exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates? Mr. Best.
Yes, this is Harlan Best. Thank you. The company has provided supporting documentation that if they were to file a cost study in... that the rate would actually increase, so staff would recommend the granting of a three-year waiver so the present rate can continue until the next cost study is filed in mid-2010.
Sounds like that makes sense. Thank you very much. Any questions by commissioners? If not, is there a motion?
A motion, TC07118, that pursuant with the staff's request that we grant the exemption from developing company-specific cost base switch access rates.
Is there a discussion by the commission? Mr. Smith, do you have a comment?
Commissioner Colbeck, would that exemption be limited to 3 years?
Yes. Thank and that's what I was trying to say at the beginning with the staff's recommendations, I guess.
Thank you.
Any further discussion by the commission? If not, Commissioner Johnson.
I vote aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. Motion carries. The next item is item 4 in the matter of the petition for arbitration pursuant to Telecommunications Act of 1996 to resolve issues relating to an interconnection agreement in dockets TC07-111, 07112, 113, 114, 115, and 116. The applicant in each item has file a request for unresolved issues as well as request for certain relief. On March 17th, Altel filed a motion to compel responses to discovery requests. The question before the commission today is, shall the commission grant the motion to compel the responses to discovery requests? We will hear from Altel first. I was going to ask for Mr. Wieczorek.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Simpson's going to take the lead or in explaining Altel's position, so I defer to him at this point.
Thank you.
Thanks. This is Sean Simpson. Yeah, consistent with what was just mentioned, Altel filed motion to compel in each of the related arbitrations, and they're essentially the same because the discovery requests are the same. The numbering was a little bit different in each one, but the discovery request and the motion to compel all deal with the same type of material, and I'll use, I guess, Alliance as the example here since it's the first one on the docket. Essentially what Altel seeks is information related to kind of two sets of information. The first one deals with some of the requests that were made, specifically 11, 12, and 20 within the discovery request, and what Altel was seeking was the work papers, the documentation and the other support that supports the investments that were indicated in the cost study that was disclosed previously. This is an arbitration over reciprocal compensation rate. In support of that, they have disclosed or handed over what purports to be a forward-looking economic cost model with some various inputs into that model. And so what we sought was basically the work papers and the documentation that support those inputs. And what we got back with respect to, for example, the switch investment in question number 11 was a page document that basically listed aggregate numbers with no component parts. And so when we asked for what the inputs were on switch investment, we got the entirety of the switch investment, which really doesn't give us very much information. It doesn't give us what the component parts of that switch are, what the cost of that switch are, what type of switch it is. One of the problems that we see is that they describe their switch as a soft switch technology. Well, without knowing what the component parts of that switch are, we don't really know how that works. And so we're unable to kind of analyze how that investment number is either appropriate or not appropriate, or analyze whether or not the component parts that make up that number are appropriate. And so with respect to those, we switch investment and other type of investments, we received conclusory information, and we simply sought the underlying supporting documentation. In subsequent discussions with counsel for the RLEX, we did get some additional information, some other discovery, but the other thing that they said was they were going to try to work and see if they could come up with some more information to provide to us that was responsive to our request, i.e. the documentation, supporting papers. We still haven't received that yet. It's my understanding that information is forthcoming, but
we didn't receive it at the time we put together the motion to compel. If we do receive that information, I guess it's no harm, no foul. I mean, I guess we'll receive it, but the problem is that we'll receive it after the time for direct testimony due. Direct testimony was due yesterday on the 24th. We did file that, but what we did when we filed our direct testimony is point out very clearly what information we saw, what information is missing, and why and what the impact is of not getting that information on our ability to analyze and refute or confirm the cost study. So to the extent that information on those discovery requests 11, 12, and 20 related to the investments and supporting documentation, if we do get that information, we can discuss whether or not it's adequate once we get it, but we just don't have it yet. The other, I guess, bucket of information that we saw deals with at least with Alliance 24, or 22, 24, 34, and 35. And this particular group of requests deals with the issue of how forward-looking economic cost per unit can be calculated for transport electronics. What we see and what our experts saw in looking at it is that the ARLEX decided to use what is known as a path approach. They simply looked at the number of trunks and added up the investment based upon the number of trunks that there was. That's a simple way of saying it. But what our cost consultant did said, well, he doesn't want to use the path approach. And under FCC rules, you don't necessarily have to use the path approach. There's a couple approaches you can use. And what he decided to do was to take a look at it on a DS1 or DSO equivalent and see what are the capacity, what is the bandwidth, what is the usage, and try to calculate the unit cost based upon that approach. So we simply asked some questions dealing with the bandwidth and the usage capacity that is specific to each of the ARLEX. They refused to provide that information based upon relevancy. They said that they didn't use that when putting together their cost study, so therefore it's irrelevant. We countered by saying, well, you may think it's irrelevant because you didn't use it. That's not the approach you took. But in order to analyze, confirm, rebut, or to build our own, I guess, alternative to that particular piece of the cost study, we'd like this information. And this information is clearly readily available. It simply asks what your bandwidth is on certain types of transport facilities and what your usage is currently in those transport facilities. And then now they've come back and said, well, it's not only irrelevant, but it's unduly burdensome, or their experts don't have that information. Well, their experts may not have that information. That's correct, because they didn't put that together, but the individual ARLEX and their engineering crew certainly do have that information, and what our cost consultant and our expert needs that information for is to simply develop an alternative approach to the path approach that was taken by them. Again, this is more clearly, and I guess specifically laid out within our motion papers, but again, it falls into two buckets of information. One is supporting documentation to like the switch investment that was conclusory stated, And the other was some usage, capacity, and bandwidth information in order for us to develop maybe an alternative approach to what was used in the cost study, to rebut that cost study, or even to test the reasonableness of that cost study. So we think what we've done here is pare down the information that we need to what is essential. We did file testimony yesterday. That testimony, again, lays out what we think we still need, what we didn't get, and why that information is essential. What we're asking for, and we initially asked for to delay the filing of the testimony, the direct testimony, given the fact that we didn't get on the calendar till today, and the timing involved, we did go ahead and submit direct testimony again with those cautionary notes in it. What we'd like to do is have the ability then, depending on what we get from the petitioners on the information they've already agreed to provide us, and what your ruling is today or sometime thereafter, we'd like the ability to provide supplemental direct testimony, and then from there modify the scheduling order and have the rebuttal testimony be 2 weeks after the additional supplemental direct testimony comes in. That's it in a nutshell. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Is there anyone else from Altel to make any presentation at this time? If not, we will turn to Ms. Moore. Are you representing the other parties?
Yes, Chairman Hansen, thank you. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of the six petitioners in TC 07-111 through 116. Mr. Simpson is in fact correct. The motions to compel discovery in these matters are essentially identical, and all four specific questions that he referred to are identical for all of the companies. So therefore, I will address our arguments on behalf of each of the petitioners and address them, in fact, to all of the petitioners.
Thank you.
Mr. Simpson characterizes the dispute as being related to Alltel not receiving specific, essential, technical information. I don't think we need to get that technical in order to understand what the true crux of the argument is here. The purpose of discovery is obviously to exchange information on the claims and defenses raised by both parties. And Alltel, as the responding party, has a right to hold the petitioners to their obligations under the FCC rules and regulations with regard to the completion of FLEX studies. And that is to determine whether the FLEX study is reasonable and supportable. In our responses to Alltel's motion to compel, the six petitioners essentially laid out the steps that they have taken to date to address Alltel's specific questions. And that initially started with a 62-page document that detailed the FLEX study and also provided the numbers, the inputs, the data that went into that FLEX study. That also included a CD that would have allowed the viewing party to essentially analyze the FLEX study, see how it was put together. We thereafter served discovery on one another, and Alltel didn't serve discovery in round one, but served discovery in the second round. And at that point in time, served approximately 58 or 60 questions, depending on which petitioner we're dealing with in this instance, seeking additional information. At that point in time, we put together a fairly lengthy response, and I would disagree with the characterization that that response was conclusory in any way, shape, or form, because I think what we did was we built on the information that was already provided to Alltel, and it built on the specifics that were used by our cost consultants in this case to put together the FLEX study and to support that. And essentially what we're looking at here is discovery on the part of Alltel that frankly just goes too far. They're attempting to hold the petitioners to a higher standard than what is required of them pursuant to the specific FCC rules, and particularly those governing the development of FLEX studies. And I'll just take a few questions off the table initially, and those would be what Mr. Simpson referred to as 11, 12, and 20 relating to work papers, documentations, and supporting costs. Again, we think we provided adequate information, but in several conference calls with counsel for Alltel after this that also included our cost consultants, we did agree to provide some supplemental information, and we have marshaled the appropriate individuals, the engineers, to come up with some of those and believe we'll be able to provide those here in the next couple of days, and we'll certainly do that. However, we think what we've already provided to Alltel is ample information, and that whatever we provide next will certainly be ample information. And with regard to those specific requests, we would object to Alltel essentially having an opportunity for a continuing objection, so to speak, on whether we have in fact provided reasonable information. And so in that regard, I think what we've already provided is reasonable. We've committed to providing more, which I don't think we had any obligation to do under our discovery rules, and we'll do that as soon as possible. But with regard to a continuing objection, or essentially allowing Alltel to push back the dates, that could ultimately jeopardize our ultimate hearing date in this particular docket, or these dockets, excuse me, and really would put the petitioners in a prejudicial position. They would be prejudiced, in fact. So with regard to those three questions, we'll supplement to the extent that we can. With regard to the second grouping of information that Mr. Simpson references, this is irrelevant in our minds, and it's not only irrelevant, but it's unduly burdensome. Mr. Simpson indicated that the petitioners selected the PATH approach and that Alltel's own cost consultant chose to use a different approach. And that's just fine, but it's the petitioners who carry the ultimate burden here to establish why they used the PATH approach and what they used in doing so.
And essentially what Alltel is requesting in its discovery would be information that isn't readily available, contrary to Mr. Simpson's comments. And not only is it not information that it's available, but it would ultimately place a burden also on our cost consultants to essentially rerun the FLEX study again. I would liken the requests to picking and choosing what data they believe to be pertinent and what data they believe might have an impact on the ultimate FLEX study. And to that end, if the numbers, when I say the numbers, I mean specifically they've requested the current minutes of usage that were employed. That essentially would require our consultants to go back and rerun the FLEX study to ensure it was done correctly. That's not an obligation imposed by the FCC rules. And moreover, if you rerun one portion of the FLEX study, you have to rerun everything using the current numbers. And that's not the purpose of the FLEX study. It's a forward-looking economic model, not a current embedded cost model. And so from that standpoint, essentially what Alltel is looking to do is obtain certain information that it believes might be beneficial. However, if it's not, I suspect we'll never see that in any of their own testimony. So essentially what's happening is our cost consultants might be put in a position where they have to run this particular FLEX study ad infinitum. In other words, in order to satisfy our own burden and to ensure that our own rates are reasonable, we would have to run it not only using the path approach, but using the bandwidth approach that Alltel wants to use and using any other approach that might also be available. And that's simply not the burden. As is clearly established by the FCC rules, the petitioners simply need to propose a FLEX study to support that with data and then to be able to articulate that. And if Alltel believes that it has a viable argument that the FLEX study is either unreasonable, it's not based on legitimate data, figures, or theories, or the overarching methodology, it can certainly attack that through its own cost consultants who are clearly well-versed in this area and who have testified in other arbitration proceedings before this commission. And it can also do so through cross-examination of the petitioner's cost consultants in this point in time. Again, it's the petitioner who holds the ultimate burden, and it's not Alltel who has the opportunity to ultimately turn this into a rate-making proceeding as opposed to a determination of whether the rates for transport and termination that have been advanced are appropriate. And I think one of the easiest ways to understand this, to steal an analogy from a colleague that worked on this particular case, it's much like looking at an audited financial statement. At some point in time, you close the books. You don't go back, and no matter how many more entries you put in the books, and essentially change the past year's audited financial statements. That's simply not the way it's done. The FLEX model is designed to be a moment's look in time, to capture the particular data from that and to look at developing a technologically efficient and reasonably priced model going forward. That's what our cost consultants have done in this particular case. That is the information that we have provided to Alltel. We don't believe anything beyond that is relevant. And frankly, to grant the motion to compel with regard to these particular requests, I would submit the commission would open the process up for a certain amount of abuse. In other words, what doesn't become fair game? What number doesn't have to be requested and re-input into the FLEX study? And I think what we have done in this particular case is provided ample opportunity for Alltel to explore the FLEX study. We've provided ample information to respond, to their discovery requests, and don't believe that we have anything further at this point in time to provide. So therefore, with regard to the motion to compel on the second grouping of questions addressed by Mr. Simpson, we would respectfully request that the commission deny that request. And again, with regard to any sort of continuing objection on whether this information is relevant, and if this information should in fact be provided, we would object to any delay in the filing of testimony whether that be supplemental direct testimony or rebuttal testimony, because, again, it puts our ultimate hearing dates in this particular matter in jeopardy. And we're already at the end of April, and I would suspect at this point in time that it would be very difficult to obtain new dates in a significant block of time, as would be required to get on the commission's calendar again before quite some time, and that puts my clients in a significantly disadvantaged position with regard to this particular matter. And again, we think that there's been ample time at this point to conduct discovery. We've provided that, and we believe it's sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Nice.
If I could, this is Sean again, if I could just have one opportunity just to address that.
Well, I guess I can allow that at this juncture. We'd like to hear from staff on this as well. And why don't we hear from staff, then we'll jump back to you after we've...
Thank you.
Karen, what do you have on first base on this?
Yeah, this is Karen Kramer from staff, and... this is a matter of discovery between the parties, and so staff normally does not weigh in on such matters. I don't know what their experts require in order to write their testimony. It appears that as to 11, 12, and 20, you know, on that I don't know that you need to make a decision. See what they supplement, see if they still need more. I would hold on that. But as to the second set, staff has no opinion.
Thank you.
Mr. Might I ask Ms. Kramer a clarification question on her recommendation?
Go right ahead.
You, Ms. Kramer, you indicated that we wouldn't need to take action on 11, 12, or 20. What does that do? I mean, you know, there were filings that were due yesterday. Does staff have any opinion on what should be done with regard to a timeline, a schedule going forward?
Dusty, I'm not, I didn't know if I heard you entirely.
My question is, you know, we've got difficulties with schedule here. We've had a request for the extension of a deadline, and I was just curious if staff had an opinion on that.
And I don't know that, you know, depending on what they get for testimony and if it's, or for discovery and if it's satisfactory, I have no idea if we would be able to schedule a meeting hearing 2 weeks later or not. I have no idea what the calendar looks like in May. We would have to check with Ms. Forney to see then the soonest hearing dates. I think right now it's scheduled for 3 days in April. Generally, 3 days aren't a terrible burden to find on a calendar, but I don't know that.
And if I can maybe address that point, maybe we can clear this up. This is Sean from Altel, and I apologize. But just to answer that specific question, with respect to the deadline that was yesterday for direct testimony, we did file direct testimony, and so did the petitioners in this matter. I guess the issue going forward is, if we're just talking about this first set of requests, 11, 12, and 20, where they're agreeing to provide additional information, if we knew when that information was going to come, we would be in a better position to know what the future looked like. You know, I think that right now we have rebuttal testimony that's currently scheduled to be due, I think, in 2 weeks, and that's a short timeline. If we don't get, you know, we not only have to review what they gave us in terms of testimony last Monday, but what they're going to additionally give us, which should have been given to us before. So I think the thing that we need to probably talk about is when we expect that information on that first bucket of requests to come to us, and two, whether or not we can extend, do one of two things, either allow a time for supplemental direct testimony to be filed by X date, and I would propose that once we, you know, receive whatever additional information we're going to get, we can be in a position to at least file some type of supplemental direct testimony within a week, and then from there schedule the rebuttal testimony 2 weeks after that. So the other I guess alternative is just simply extend the deadline for rebuttal testimony so that we can be given an opportunity to review the additional discovery that we may get and incorporate that into rebuttal testimony.
Okay, thanks.
But I think that brings up the idea of when you look at these two buckets of information, in terms of getting the additional supporting documentation, whenever we get that, we should be in a position to further, clarify and supplement our direct testimony. With respect to the second cluster of information that we've requested that Mrs. or that counsel believes to now be not only irrelevant but unduly burdensome, I would just make a couple of comments. One is we're not asking that they rerun the FLEX study. The request doesn't do that. What it simply asks for example, in 28, we just provide the bandwidth of additional transiting circuits. That's a straightforward question that they certainly have at their disposal. And the fact that they chose to use one path, and we may want to rebut that path with some additional information, and the reason we ask that is we're not the possessors of this information. They are. This isn't an asymmetrical cost study. This is a cost study built upon their network. So they're the possessors of this information, and they're the ones that can give us that. And in terms of ultimately proving or establishing the reasonableness of the FLEX study, this goes directly to that. This information will allow us to tell us whether or not that FLEX study is reasonable, and it's certainly information within their disposal. They just don't want to use that information because it may, in fact, and probably does, call into serious question the reasonableness of their path method for the cost study. So it's understandable why they don't want to give that information, but simply because one party doesn't want to give it doesn't mean that it's irrelevant. We certainly think it goes straight to the heart of the reasonableness of that cost study. And if we could get that information someplace else, we certainly would. But we can't get it someplace else. We need to get it from them. And that's why we've asked the question. And we don't really have any evidence or anything other than it's burdensome. Well, why is it burdensome? If it's simply asking for bandwidth or quantity of trunks per DSO or per DS1, that certainly doesn't appear to me to be unduly burdensome. It's a question that's pretty straightforward. With respect to ultimately affecting the timing of this, I understand that, but the fact of the matter is Altel shouldn't be prejudiced because we're on a time schedule. If we ask for information, we should be able to get that information in order to determine, and for the commission to determine whether or not they've actually met their burden of proof in this case in terms of the reasonableness of it. So with that, I would leave it at those two buckets of information and have a little bit of a different bent on how we're going to deal with it.
Ms. Weist?
First, I would have a question for Ms. Moore. Going to that, what they call the second bucket of information, do you have an estimate, or maybe you said, how long it would take the petitioners to get that information?
I don't at this point in time. When we originally talked with Altel, we addressed these particular questions. I took those back to both sets of cost consultants that we're working with in this particular matter. They indicated it would require data requests to the petitioners, and that could take some time to get that. Additionally, I know this wasn't directly your question, but the ultimate implication is, of course, that would require us to do some additional analysis of our own, because it essentially causes us to not only analyze this under the path method, but also under the bandwidth method. So while the statement is that it doesn't cause us to rerun the FLEX study, the ultimate implication and direct consequence is that would be required. So therefore, it's not quite as simple as how quickly can we get the information, but what ultimate impact obtaining that information and providing it has on not only what's been done to date, but also what needs to be done in the future.
So when you talk about rerunning a FLEX study, your point is not necessarily that in order to give them the information, you would need to rerun the FLEX study. Your position is that since they're asking for this information in order to rebut whatever possible, things that they can come up with respect to the bandwidth approach, then you would need to run the FLEX study with the bandwidth approach. Is that correct?
Well, I think there's a portion of that that's true, but additionally, if you look at it just in that context, we're extracting one little element that goes into the entirety of the FLEX study with regard to bandwidth versus the path approach, and then you would need to reinsert all of the other numbers as well. So it's not quite as simple as just taking a look at one particular issue. It ultimately goes to the FLEX study as a whole, So one, it's overly burdensome to provide the information because it's not something that's readily available. It would require the data request, and then there are the direct consequences that has on everything that's been done to date, as well as future filings and future arguments that would be made. And it would be our contention that Altel can do that through its own cost consultants and questions and areas that they can essentially point out as potentially lacking, and then ask those same questions of our consultants in cross-examination.
But when you're talking about data requests, you're talking about just getting information from the petitioners, right?
So that's a fair statement. I think that's oversimplifying it, but yes, that's essentially what the request is a request for data.
Okay. If the commissioners have any questions, that's fine. Then I could make a recommendation.
Certainly. Appreciate that. Questions by commissioners? Ms. Moore, did you have anything to add? We went through a process there where Mr. Simpson was given an opportunity to speak. Did you have any statements in regard to what he had said, or do you feel you explained that sufficiently from the question that Ms. Weiss asked?
Just briefly with regard to the scheduling issue, Chairman Hansen, Altel indicated that it doesn't believe it should be prejudiced by a lack of information, but ultimately what the parties originally agreed to in December of this case was a scheduling order that essentially allowed for three rounds or periods of discovery. And the first one was whereby we, the petitioners, provided a significant amount of information regarding the flex study, and then there were two subsequent periods for written discovery. Altel didn't participate in the first round of written discovery, and so therefore any claim now that they are going to be somewhat disadvantaged or prejudiced because we didn't give this information, I think is somewhat disingenuous, because they certainly had an opportunity to serve on the petitioner's discovery during the first round. It didn't do so. So with regard to that claim, that would be my only comment, again, that I think we've agreed to a schedule, and therefore to try to put that off at this point isn't what was originally contemplated by the parties or is what is ultimately fair to the petitioners in this case. Thank you.
Your Honors, Altel didn't serve the first round of discovery because we were in the process of going through six forward-looking economic cost studies, and during that time we weren't in a position to serve discovery on that cost study because we had just received it. And we're going through it, and then that's why we built in the additional discovery that what she calls the third is really the second opportunity for discovery. And simply, we did what we were supposed to do on the schedule. We evaluated the flex study, and we served discovery on that flex study in that second round, because during the first round, we were looking at the flex study. And so, I don't know how, you know, somehow that we exercised our rights when we were supposed to and served discovery. Now all of a sudden we should be penalized for not doing it earlier. We did it when we were supposed to.
Close the discussion to commissioners at this juncture, and ask Ms. Weist for her comments. I have to say I found it very interesting having come into this process. Frankly, it looked like a no-brainer from the standpoint of the standard is pretty broad and just simply states that something that may lead to admissible evidence, although after having gone through the discussion and listening to Ms. Moore's explanations, I have to say that I'm leaning towards the not compelling the motion. So I'll ask, and you might want to turn your mic off for any comments in the background there from folks that are on the phone. Ms. Weist, what is your recommendation?
My recommendation is to grant the motion to compel. First of all, I don't think Altel missed any deadlines with respect to discovery requests. Also, I think that Altel does have the ability to challenge the reasonableness of the flex method, and I assume that they can do this through the bandwidth approach. And I believe that information is with the petitioners, and that's how they can get the information. And so I would recommend that the commissioners grant the motion to compel. And then with respect to the schedule, I guess that would all be depending on what the commissioners do or don't do, on when they could actually provide that second
that they call bucket of information if the commission so compels them to do so. And at that, so at this point, if they could do that within a week or something, then I think what we could do is we could allow, we would put off the rebuttal testimony and then give Altel, it would have to be a pretty short time frame to do any supplemental direct, but then the petitioners would have the opportunity to respond to that in their rebuttal, and I think it's all, everybody's going to do simultaneous rebuttal testimony.
Thank you. Any questions from the commissioners?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Dusty Johnson. Rolaine, do you, Ms. Weiss, do you, I mean, it seems as though that the petitioners are they've expressed a willingness to respond to those first bucket of requests more fully. Do you view the commission action on the first bucket differently than you do on the second bucket?
Well, apparently they're going to respond to those in a couple of days. I think that all the information does meet the discovery parameters and should be compelled. Maybe I don't quite understand your question.
No, I know you've answered my question. Thanks very much. And my second question would deal with the timeline. Is it cumbersome to wait to see when this information comes in and then set sort of a scheduling order, or does it make, or to revise, you know, the schedule, or does it make more sense maybe to have a schedule in mind, you know, X number of days after, you know, Y is received, then, you know, a supplemental direct is required? I mean, is that sort of what you're proposing?
You could go that route, though. Actually, since I have no idea, I don't know, I mean, if the commission were to grant the entire motion to compel, when that second information would come in, it might make more sense to find out when that comes in and then actually deal with the schedule.
That would presumably would require an ad hoc meeting, which I certainly don't have a problem with. It's just if our interest is in moving expeditiously with this, sometimes an ad hoc is an obstacle to that.
Or, of course, it would be possible, I think, that the staff and the parties could get together and hopefully agree on some sort of revised schedule without having the commissioners have to come together for an ad hoc.
Well, that'd be wonderful. Mr. Chairman, those are the only questions I have for Ms. Weiss. Thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Kovac, did you have any questions?
Well, I'm just a little confused as far as the broadband and the line item. Could you explain that to me? It kind of reminds me of forecast test year on the electrical side. Is that kind of what it refers to?
Well, I'm certainly not the person to explain the two methods very well, actually. I'm just going by, it appears to be that they took one method to doing the flex study. Altel is looking at the reasonableness, or probably trying to evaluate the reasonableness of that method by looking at a different method, and it's my understanding that in order to do that, they need information from the RLX, from the petitioners, in order to do that. And I would think that if a person is trying to, you know, look at the reasonableness of a method by exploring another method, I don't see where that's outside the realm of discovery.
I just I'm a little concerned about that right now.
You might
saw.
I'm sorry, if that presents an extra burden on the petition.
It certainly could be a burden on the petitioners. The question is whether it's, you know, really outweighed by what Altel is really entitled to do in order to make their case.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
I think Greg has a question.
Chairman, if I may.
Yes, please.
The whole idea of a flex study is I think we could call that a forecast. I would call it a whole lot more than that, actually. The forecast tester that the electric companies file look relatively mild compared to these forward-looking economic cost studies, in my opinion. But that's just the nature of what the FCC has required.
So I have a question. This is both for Ms. Weiss as well as Mr. Rislock. The bandwidth approach
not having familiarity with flex study or the PATH approach, how great of a difference, if you know, is there between a bandwidth and a flex study?
If Relaine has that answer off her head, Chairman,
I'm talking just semantics here.
I mean, the problem is I'm pretty much limited to what I've been given by the parties. I haven't seen, I mean, the direct testimony hasn't even been posted. I didn't even know it was in. And so, you know, I don't have all the information that the other parties, all I'm doing is relying on the arguments that they're presenting and their explanation of what they need. So maybe Greg has a better.
The problem I have with this, if I may, is that it does call for the most efficient method of an incremental method of building a network. And that doesn't exactly mean there's one method preferred by one company that's necessarily the best. There may be other methods that could prove to be more efficient. And in my point of view, I guess that's all fair game for the commission to consider when looking at these cost studies. And so it's difficult to say that one method is better than the other method, at least from my point of view.
Well, the reason I was asking was just trying to get an idea from staff as to what they felt most comfortable with. There are so many different types of studies that can be done in a variety of areas, and when we start talking about cost studies, it's my concern that if in fact a PATH approach is sufficient, then we can have another study and another study and another study, and standpoint just how many studies do we need if, in fact, the one that process that we're going through at the present time is going to be sufficient for staff and for the commission to reach a reasonable and valid conclusion, then why go through all of the other processes? And that's a statement as much as a question for staff to give me some direction of where their comfort level is. Because you folks are going to be dealing with it and advising.
Well, part of the problem we're facing here is that we were very familiar with what AT&T did about 10 years ago or so, but not nearly as familiar with the companies we're talking about here. And so, really, even though it's been around since the Telecom Act, these laws, it's, from my point of view, dealing with these smaller companies in Altel, it's a new ball game for me, to be honest about it. When we're talking about these methods, I don't know if anyone has a method. I've apparently missed it. I wish they'd stand up and let me know, you know, what this commission has decided on this issue.
I have no doubt that one study is more involved than another study, that there's a variety of studies that can give us information, but at what level is a study enough for us to make the decision we need?
I assume Altel's argument would be that they need, this is just one method, I assume, that they would be using to attack the reasonableness of the particular type of flex study that the petitioners are proposing.
And yet, if there's ambiguity, the it's shouldered by the petitioner.
Well, but in order for them, my understanding is that in order for Altel to take this approach is that they need information from the petitioners. And then without that information, they may not be able to, you know, go down this path, so to speak.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Kolbeck.
I guess I understand why Ms. Kramer took her position more and more. I guess I'm very confused as to, not very confused, but I'm curious as to know what is the burden that can be put on the petitioner. Is that what we decide, or is that a precedent that we're setting with this decision if we were to compel, or how does that, I mean, in any other forward-looking economic cost study, are we saying that it's going to be what any either side decides, or are we making a precedent as to how this information is going to be looked at?
Well, I believe all, what Altel is trying to do is, I mean, you can attack the numbers of their flex study itself, but then another approach you can take is say, what is the reasonableness, you know, instead of just looking at the numbers that were put into it, what's the reasonableness of that approach itself? And in my opinion, Altel should be able to do both.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions by commissioners? If not, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the commission approve the motion to compel.
Okay. Is there a discussion on that motion?
Is there, do we need to have any discussion on the timeline at this time?
Well, we would, if it passes, we will.
Okay.
I'll ask for the vote then. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes no. The motion carries. We are, from a standpoint of the timeline, I'm reluctant to have that discussed, and we've tried that before, and it's generally best to have the staff work through that process rather than having a lot of calendars here. Staff has access to the commissioner's calendars, and as we, they can place things on there, and they certainly do. And so we'll allow them to go through that process. It's been, I brought to my attention that one of the parties here has a pressing matter to take care of, and so we'll take a 15-minute break. Excuse me, have we concluded the items on TC07111 through 116 at this juncture? I don't think there's any other questions, are there? Then we will take a 15-minute break and be back here in, according to this clock, at 25 after. The commission will come back to order. We are going to start with item number 7 at this juncture and then go back to our regular agenda with all of the other items. TC08-032 is item number 7 in the matter of the petition of Quest Corporation for waiver of utilization threshold requirement in the Huron, South Dakota Rate Center. The question before the commission is, shall the commission grant the petition for waiver of the utilization threshold requirement? Quest is still on the line, I hope?
Yes, Chair. This is Jason Topp from Quest.
Good morning. Would you like to proceed?
Sure. Pursuant to the national numbering guidelines, as well as the FCC third report and order, in situations where Quest wants to provide a block of 1,000 numbers, a smaller block of numbers, we need to go to state commissions to get approval before in order to obtain that smaller block. We have a customer that has requested 400 consecutive numbers in the Huron Rate Center, and in order to meet their request, we have put together an application and asked that the commission waive our utilization threshold requirements outlined in the FCC's orders related to these issues. The FCC generally has allowed for waiver of these rules when there is a specific customer request such as this, and we ask that the commission do so here.
Thank you very much. Staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Owens.
Quest has shown that there was a specific customer request, and therefore we do recommend approval with the condition that Quest return the 1,000 block if the customer withdraws the request.
Thank you. Looks like an economic development opportunity. Any questions by the commission? If not, is there a motion on item number 7?
I move. Oh,
Go right ahead.
Motion on TC08-032 that the commission grant the petition for waiver of the utilization threshold requirement on the recommendations of staff.
Thank you. Is there a discussion on that motion? If not, Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Colbert.
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. Motion carries. We are now back to our original agenda and item number 6 in the matter of the petitions for suspension or modification of 47 U.S.C. Section 251B2 of the Communications Act of 1934 as amended in dockets TC08, 006, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, and 27. On February 29th, petitions for intervention were filed by Midcontinent Communications, Alltel Communications, LLC, Verizon Wireless, LLC, ComNet Cellular License Holding, LLC, Missouri Valley Cellular, Incorporated, Sanborn Cellular, Incorporated, Eastern South Dakota Cellular, Incorporated, doing business as Verizon Wireless, Sprint Communications Company, LPMCC, Telephony of the Midwest, Incorporated, doing business as Mediacom, and the South Dakota Telecommunications Association. The question before the commission today is, shall the commission grant intervention to the parties that have filed in the dockets above, and how shall the commission proceed? I'd like to hear first from those persons who have petitioned for intervention, and I don't know whether to flip a coin or just run down the list, but I see a number of folks are here, and we have a number of people on the phone as well. I'll take them according to how they're listed in TC08-017, because that encompasses all of the folks. And if you are speaking on behalf of more than one of the companies, please let us know. First up would be Midcontinent Communications.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Dave Gervis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Midcontinent Communications. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to pass out a an exhibit.
Thank you.
Mr. Gertis, this is Dusty Johnson. Is this exhibit you're passing out something that's been filed with the commission for? Or?
No, it is not, Commissioner Johnson. What it is, it's a depiction of the manner in which Midcontinent uses VoIP in its plant.
Oh, sure. No, I've seen graphs and graphic depictions of that in the past, so I think I probably have an idea of what you passed out. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, two entities have objected, I believe, to the intervention, proposed intervention of Midcontinent, and and both have filed written objections, and so I'd like to respond to those objections. Essentially, they're saying that since we're a carrier that does not is not a VoIP carrier, that we shouldn't be in the docket. And of course, that's not true. And if you look at our intervention petition, we talk about the fact that depending upon the manner in which the commission were to fashion relief for the petitioners If it was fashioned too broadly, it would, not could, would adversely affect the manner in which Mid-Continent does business in this state. And we've alleged that there is potentially a direct financial impact, again, depending upon the manner in which the commission would grant relief. We would submit that on its face that's sufficient to get in under the statute. But I need to first mention that historically, this commission has liberally applied the intervention statutes, and generally speaking, I believe that that has resulted in good in a good approach to dockets in front of the commission. But really, the position that Mid-Continent has here doesn't need a liberal interpretation. There is a direct financial impact. If you look at the rules and the statute that applies to intervention in administrative procedures, it talks about specifically a party that has a pecuniary interest that would be directly and immediately affected by the agency's order. And Mid-Continent believes that it would be directly affected, again, depending upon the manner in which the commission fashioned relief to the petitioners. I've handed out, and the reason I say that is Mid-Continent does, in fact, use voice over internet protocol, VoIP, in its plan. And the manner in which the commission were to grant relief could or could not affect Mid-Continent, but I would submit to you that we are certainly entitled to be a party in this these proceedings in order to make sure that our manner of doing business in the state would not be affected. We've also alleged in our petition to intervene that we do business in both rural and non-rural local exchanges, and clearly, Mid-Continent is entitled to have a business plan that would involve entering other exchanges. Mid-Continent is not in every exchange in the state, and so therefore, if the wrong relief was defined in this manner, Mid-Continent may very well not be able to continue expanding its footprint. Let me explain I hope I can explain it, the diagram that I passed out. Figure number one, first of all, this is a diagram of Mid-Continent's operations and as it relates to, depending upon the diagram you're looking at, as it relates to the types of calls. If you look at figure one, which is the first page of the three-page diagram that I've handed out, the three-page exhibit, excuse me, that depicts a VoIP-to-VoIP voice conversation between Mid-Continent customers in the local exchange. And if you look over on the left, it shows this dark line that's between the two telephones on the left, and that dark line goes through the CMTS, which is the cable modem termination system. And when you have a VoIP-to-VoIP conversation between Mid-Continent customers in the same exchange, that is exactly what happens. It connects the customer to another one in the digital phone community. The call is switched within the cable modem termination system, and that system terminates the call appropriately without leaving the local network. So this is a call that occurs totally on by means of voice over internet protocol. So then if you go to the second figure, you'll know
excuse me, Mr. Gertis, for interrupting.
Yes.
Before you continue, I'd just like to point out for those persons who are listening telephonically that our staff has placed or is in the process of placing. It's my understanding that the exhibits have been placed on the web so that they would be able to access those at this time.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Hansen, and I apologize. I should have gotten them to staff yesterday, and we could have done that. That's my oversight, and I apologize. If you look at the second picture, you'll see the dark line going from the telephone in the lower left-hand corner of the exhibit, and it goes directly up to the top. And that depicts a VoIP to POTS, which is plain old telephone service, call. And this connects a Mid-Continent customer with another local customer in the same exchange, but on some other carrier's network. For instance, let's just take Mitchell as an example. And if a Mid-Continent commissioner were to call if a Mid-Continent customer were to call a Quest customer in Mitchell, this is what this would depict. And you'd have a VoIP call or a call on VoIP being initiated, but the call is then switched, and at the cable modem termination system and handed off at an interconnection point through the other incumbent carrier's switch, and it is terminated on POTS. So, in other words, you have a transition between a VoIP call, and which is digital, and an analog call, which is regular telephone service. And so this depicts that kind of a call. Now, if you go to the third figure, this would represent a long-distance call. The first call would connect the Mid-Continent customer with another Mid-Continent customer in another rate center. And that's the one, if you see in the upper right-hand corner there, it talks about Midco to Midco calls. We're starting at the same phone in the lower left-hand corner, but we go up to the phone in the upper right-hand corner. And if you'll notice, it goes through this switch that is over in the right, which is identified as a CS/2000 in the photograph, or in the picture. It's partially obliterated, but if you look on the prior drawings, that's the way it's identified. What that is that's Mid-Continent switch. And it is a DMS 500 switch, which is modified so that it will handle both digital and analog, signals. And so that's where you can convert, if you will, the digital signal to the analog signal in that switch. And this depicts, again, a totally Internet protocol call, because it's from one Midco customer to another. And so that is handled over, it travels on the local Internet protocol network. It then goes into the Sioux Falls switch, and the Sioux Falls switch puts it on the transport Internet protocol network. In other words, it's a local IP to a transport IP call, which is terminated with the long-distance Midco customer on the same system. And so it's a totally Internet protocol call. All right. If you then take the next call, the fourth call, where that same Mitchell customer is calling somebody in, a Quest customer in Pierre, let's say, that terminates in the lower right-hand corner, where you've got the little clouds that say MCI, Broadwing, or Quest. And what happens there is the call starts again in the Mid-Continent with a Mid-Continent customer in Mitchell, goes through this CS2000 switch, and enters POTS, and is terminated as a long-distance analog call. And so my point simply is to show you that Internet protocol is basic to the mid-continent system. And to say that Mid-Continent does not have an interest in whether or not there'll be local number portability as it relates to persons using VoIP, if you use VoIP simply as a concept, would potentially prevent Mid-Continent from doing business. And as an example, just let me read from the opposition that was filed by Swiftel against Mid-Continent's intervention. Paragraph 4 of that opposition on page 2, and it's very short, I'll just read it, says, Swiftel's petition on its face is limited to its obligation in connection with the provision of LNP to wireless carriers and interconnected VoIP providers. Well, certainly, Mid-Continent is interconnected, and certainly, Mid-Continent is, to the extent that it uses VoIP in its internal network and in its switch, it is a VoIP provider. Now, it's not Vonage or one of those other companies that bypasses switches or has the potential to bypass switch, but nonetheless, Mid-Continent employs VoIP technology. And so I guess I need to emphasize that VoIP is a technology. It's not a methodology. When you use the term VoIP, you're talking about something that's very specific. I'm looking at Newton's telecom directory definition of VoIP. It says, Voice over Internet Protocol, the technology used to transmit voice conversations over a data network using Internet Protocol. It's technology. It can be employed in many different ways and in many different applications. Mid-Continent uses it to transport its internal signaling, and it also has determined a way to interface between VoIP and analog signals. So what we're saying is we should be part of this process because we as a local exchange carrier should be entitled to local number portability just like we have now in ITC's area, just like we have in the Quest areas, and that we are not we should not be adversely affected by a suspension of local number portability simply because we utilize the VoIP technology in our plant, because we don't think that's who they're after. But nonetheless, we should be part of the process to make sure that there's not a broader order issued than what is necessary to provide the relief that the petitioners are asking.
Thank you, Mr. Gertis. Mr. Wisorik, are you representing Altel Communications?
Local Council, Altel, and Sprint.
All right. Altel is up next, then.
Well, as to Altel, I don't believe there's been any opposition, and given that Altel has acquired Western Wireless, who has a long history of requesting portability from the RLEX, I think it's clear that we have an interest in these proceedings and should be allowed to intervene.
Thank you. And did you say you're representing Sprint as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As to Sprint, I'm on the Commission's website, and I haven't been able to locate the materials handed out by Midco, but from the description Mr. Gertis provided, it sounds just like information and documents that have been provided by Sprint in arbitrations that it has currently pending with ITC and Swisttel. Essentially use the same type of VoIP delivery in conjunction with MCC in providing a joint service. And because of that, Sprint feels it clearly has an interest in intervening. Sprint has set forth that it does, in conjunction with MCC, provide a interconnected VoIP service as part of its competition or proposed competition in those areas. And any type of suspension of local number portability would impact Sprint's ability to compete in those markets. And we believe Sprint should be allowed to intervene to make sure that any order or suspension or modification would not impact Sprint's business model.
Thank you very much. I assume you'll be sending some compensation to Mr. Gertis for his fine work that's built the foundation for you, correct?
We'll make arrangements for compensation.
All right. Verizon is up next. Dennis Duncan, are you representing Verizon?
Yes, I am, Commissioner Hansen. Commissioners, Dennis Duncan, attorney in Parker, South Dakota, representing Verizon Wireless. Like Alltel, our motions for intervention have not been opposed, and therefore we would actually request that they be granted. We really see this as a matter that we need to get into this process and get a procedure outlined by the commission to bring the parties to the table to get these negotiations started. Otherwise, similar to what Alltel has said, a suspension of the intermodal porting would would put the Verizon in an untenable position, and we think we have an interest in this, and our intervention should be granted.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Not certain, is ComNet being represented today? Or is that
part of the
Verizon? When I see a number of, I assume ComNet,
yes.
Missouri Valley, Sanborn, yes. Eastern South Dakota are all part of Verizon?
Yes, they are.
Thank you. And we have MediaCom, Brett, Mr. Kaneki.
Good morning, Commissioners and staff. Brett Kaneki appearing for MCC Telephony, doing business as MediaCom. As the Commission is aware, we have dockets open to enter some of the markets which we're discussing here, Swisttel and some smaller ITC exchanges. I won't hand out my own description of the arrangement. I've compared it with Mr. Gertis's and jumping on his bandwagon. I'll say that it looks to me to be essentially the same. These are, as you know, are very simplistic representations of what actually occurs. But going back to the applications on file for MediaCom to enter the markets, which I previously discussed, they clearly indicate that the use of voice over IP technology will be used. And we think it's easily conceivable that an order in the dockets, which we're attempting to intervene in this morning, could prejudice MediaCom's entry into those markets. We think we're clearly entitled to intervention under the rules and practice of the commission, as I understand it to be. So we would ask that you grant our motion, or our petition, I should say, to intervene in the two dockets. We obviously haven't attempted to intervene in all of them, just in the ones for the ILECs in the markets which we seek to penetrate. Thank you.
Thank you. South Dakota Telecommunications Association, Mr. Coit. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, and staff. I think our intervention, we filed it on or about February 27th, and we're intervening in these cases, you know, for the main reason that we intervened in the prior LNP cases, and that has to deal with the transport issue that regrettably arises in the context of implementing LMP. The transport issue is an issue that the FCC has not yet addressed. And when I speak of the transport issue, I'm talking about basically the originating transport that becomes necessary to route calls out of service areas or calling areas, depending on where the wireless carrier's POI may be, or maybe even where the VoIP provider's POI may be. The transport cost issue is an industry issue. It is an industry issue that we've been very interested in for a number of years in the context of negotiations that ILECs are having with wireless carriers, and also, you know, before this commission, obviously, in various proceedings. It remains to be addressed by the FCC. It's pending in at least a couple of dockets before the FCC. I would also note that it's an issue that NTCA the National Telephone Cooperative Association, continues to raise at the federal level. As a matter of fact, recently they have actually filed an appeal from the FCC's latest LMP order and are asking for a stay of that order based on an FCC's failure to take into account adequately the costs associated with transport, particularly for small rural carriers. So basically what we have is we have a fair number of dockets here that all involve this industry issue. And because commission action in one docket might affect what the commission does in another docket, indicating obviously the nature of the issue as being an industry issue, we are very interested in these proceedings, and we feel that we should have the right to appear and make our positions as an industry known in the dockets. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coit. Is there anyone that I've missed? If not, we will go to Swiftel or...
Good morning, Mr. Commission. My name is Darla Rogers, and I should clarify that I do not represent Swiftel.
Yeah,
in this
when you got up and started approaching, I
thought, you were just looking at me, and I felt compelled to move. I'm representing the LEX in dockets 08006 through 016. Swiftel, I believe, is 08017, and then the balance of them, 08 through 027, are my clients. And since you've called upon Swiftel first,
please go right ahead.
That's Mary Sisak, yeah. And she's on the phone, and I would certainly defer to her to go first. Thank you.
All right, great. Mary Sisak?
Thank you.
You're still
with us? Oh, I'm sorry.
Please proceed. Go ahead.
First of all, Swiftel is not objecting to the intervention of the wireless carriers or SDTA. Swiftel has objected to the intervention of Midcontinent, Mediacom, and Sprint, and for the very simple reason that all three of those entities represent themselves to be telecommunications carriers and specifically local exchange carriers. I would like to first begin by saying what the pending suspension petition does. And the pending suspension petition asks for relief with respect to intermodal LNP, and that's wireline carrier to wireless carrier LNP, and VoIP LNP. And I think this is where the confusion is coming into play. VoIP LNP, as defined by the FCC, is not a telecommunications carrier service. It is not provided by a telecommunications carrier. And therefore, the FCC released this most recent order to say that even though VoIP is not a telecommunications carrier and is not a telecommunications carrier service, the FCC still imposed LNP obligations on VoIP providers, and it was necessary for them to do that because the FCC's existing rules prior to the most recent order only applied to telecommunications carriers. And so the petition that was filed by Swisttel is only requesting relief with respect to a non-telecommunications carrier interconnected VoIP provider. Now, Midcontinent and MediaCom and Sprint have all alleged that they use Internet protocol in the provision of service, but they have also alleged that they are telecommunications carriers. And if they are telecommunications carriers, the fact that they use Internet protocol as part of their service offering does not change the fact that they are entitled to the benefits of local number portability as addressed in the FCC's rules that apply to wireline carriers. And I just want to make it clear that Swisttel's petition in no way requests any relief with respect to its obligation to provide LNP to a wireline telecommunications carrier. We tried to make that point clear in our oppositions. I'm not sure if we did or not, based on the comments made by the parties requesting intervention. But that's what we're trying to do. And if there would be, I don't know, if it would make it clearer for us to file something that specifically says that our petition is not intended to request any relief with respect to LNP between a wireline carrier to a wireline carrier, we could certainly do that. I have kind of like a long list here of going through what each of these carriers has done in terms of representing themselves to be a telecommunications carrier and a local exchange carrier. And I guess I wonder if it's appropriate for me to do that at this time, or if my comments that I have just made possibly change the opinion of any of the interveners as to whether or not we're trying to capture them in some way.
I appreciate your pausing and bringing that up at this juncture, and I would that's a question that ultimately will need to be asked, so we'll ask it at this time whether or not it causes any pause on their part. So those three entities, if any of you have a comment in regards to Ms. Sissex.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, if in fact that is true, we can certainly withdraw our intervention at a later date. At this point, I think we want to be part of the docket going in when we're able to satisfy ourselves that in fact will be the outcome. I mean, there would be no point in our staying around, but at this point, we're not at all clear that that's exactly what's going to happen. Obviously, we would engage in discussions with counsel to see an appropriate ground that we could perhaps withdraw. But at this point, I think we need to be in at the outset, at least, until we can find our way out, if I may put it that way.
An exit strategy, so to speak. Thank you. First comments from the other two. Are there comments from the other two organizations?
Mr. Chairman, Talbot Wysorek.
Yes.
I would endorse again what Mr. Gerdes has said. I think it would make sense to allow the interventions at this point, and if Swisttel and the other carriers that are opposing interventions by Midco and Sprint and MCC, they could certainly propose a stipulation that we could request the Commission reduce to an order to clarify any modification or suspension in this proceeding would not apply to our business models.
Thank you. Mr. Kanicki?
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate Ms. Sissak's comments and would join with Mr. Gerdes and Mr. Wysorek in their thoughts regarding the same. It's not my intention to participate in a docket that wouldn't affect my client, but we need to decide that for ourselves and would look forward to doing so shortly. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, did you have a comment?
Well, actually, I think Mr. Wazorek got a long way there with his suggestion, and that would allow you guys maybe to answer that via stipulation discussions. But let me just ask, is it known yet among the three VoIP parties here that the other kind of VoIP that Ms. Sisak referred to is absolutely not part of your business plan? Is that foregone? And maybe you can't tell now because maybe the definition isn't clear enough for you to be able to tell, but I mean, do you actually know that at this point, that you wouldn't be, that element of the VoIP potential out there is not part of what you're looking at?
Well, Mr. Smith, for Mid-Continent, I would say that we didn't actually know it at the time we filed our intervention, and we don't actually know it now. That doesn't mean we can't be educated and we can't find a basis upon which we would be comfortable, but in our reading of the petitions that were filed, we weren't comfortable. And so there has to be a basis upon which comfort can arrive, and I'm like Mr. Kennecke, I appreciate what Ms. Sisak has said, and certainly that's an open door, and we'd love to find a way out. So, but I can't make that representation right now.
Okay, I mean, it was just a question as to how broad your petition to intervene is. I guess the allegations in it is particularly, I mean, what brings that to mind is Midco, where you're a telecommunications carrier, but you're not just a telecommunications carrier. I mean, your original business had nothing to do with telecommunications. And so and I have no idea. I guess my assumption would be that the cable bandwidth that you have provides a perfectly acceptable conduit for VoIP traffic that may have nothing to do with your status as a telecommunications carrier. And I guess I was just curious as to whether that's part of it or whether this intervention is strictly limited to your functioning as a telecommunications carrier using a VoIP technology.
Well, I think that's part of it. We are just unsure at this point, and obviously, if we don't intervene, we've given up our right to protect ourselves. If we intervene and then find out there's a way out, we'll exit. But we just can't make that representation or make that decision right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Please continue, Ms. Sisak.
Well, I have two thoughts based on the comments that were made. One is possibly it would be a solution to defer the consideration of the intervention request of Mediacom, Midco, and Sprint so that the parties or Swiftel and those entities would have an opportunity to come up with some kind of a stipulation. I would rather not grant intervention, have to start going through things like discovery and everything else with a bunch of entities that maybe ultimately are not parties. And with respect to Mr. Smith's comments, it does raise a question as to whether or not a company like Mid-Continent that doesn't even provide cable service in all of the service areas of the local exchange carriers would still have standing on the basis of maybe some future possibility that it might provide cable service or a VoIP service. So I guess I'd like some clarification from Mr. Smith about his comments on that.
Well, I'm not a spokesman for Mid-Continent, so maybe I'll let Mr. Gerdes do that, Ms. Sisak. But
So I should not interpret your comments as meaning that anybody that might provide VoIP at any time in the future would necessarily have standing in these particular cases.
I'm not suggesting anything of the kind. I was just asking whether the limits of what they're of what they're asserting in their petition is limited to their those things that they're doing as a, quote, telecommunications carrier.
Thank you. So that would be another thing that possibly Fiftel and Mid-Continent could discuss in the context of a stipulation.
It absolutely could, and that was the meaning of my preparatory comment that I made.
Thank you. Well, so that is what I throw out as a proposed solution on this point. Grant the interventions with respect to the wireless carriers and SDTA. Hold off on the other ones. Give us a chance to come up with a stipulation, and possibly this can be eliminated as an issue.
Thank you for your thoughts and suggestion. Do you have further presentation for us at this time?
Sure. I can go through my list of why all of these entities are not interconnected VoIP providers as discussed by the FCC in its LNP order. The first one is just on its face. In the Sprint motion, for example, Sprint represents that it's certified to provide local exchange services. On page 2, Sprint states that it filed a certificate of authority to provide service in Swiftel's service area. And then when you go to their petition for authority at page 4 and 5, Sprint states that it will provide to Mediacom local and whole service public PSTN interconnection, number assignment and administration functions, number porting, operator and directory assistance, and 911 services. And the key point is Sprint states, quote, this service is telecommunications service that is effectively available directly to the public. Accordingly, Sprint is a telecommunications carrier within the meaning of the Act. If you look also at Sprint's petition to intervene, they state that the voice service, which they claim is interconnected voice service, is at the customer premises. And then if you, again, look at their arbitration petition, Sprint represents that it is Mediacom that provides the service at the customer's premises. And then if you tie that to Mediacom's petition for a certificate of authority, Mediacom claims that it is a telecommunications carrier and specifically states that it seeks to provide basic local exchange services in Swiftel service territory. And then, of course, in their petition to intervene, Mediacom also alleges that it is a telecommunications carrier. And then, of course, the final point is Sprint and Mediacom are two separate entities, and Sprint's representation concerning VoIP services is actually really a representation on behalf of Mediacom. So I think when you look at all of the petitions that have been filed, Sprint and Mediacom have both alleged that with respect to the provision of service in Swiftel service territory, that they are telecommunications carriers and that they are providing local exchange service. And again, it is clear from Swiftel's petition, their current petition, that it does not impact a telecommunication or local number portability to a telecommunications carrier providing local exchange service. And the further kind of proof of that is Swiftel has a separate suspension petition pending in which the question of LNP to a wireline carrier is pending. So, and I might also point out that Mid-Continent, Mediacom, and Sprint have all intervened in that other suspension petition. And that concludes my comments.
Thank you very much. Ms. Rogers.
Thank you. I believe I've already identified petitioners I represent in this case. We would concur with the comments of Ms. Sisak. I believe that she's pointed out or done an excellent job in explaining actually why we have filed objections to granting of the petitions of Mid-Continent, and then in ITC's case, the petitions of Mediacom and Sprint as well. if you read the petitions to intervene, on their face, each one states that they are intervening as a local exchange carrier or as a telecommunications carrier. And if you look at the language in the petitions, we state, and I'll just quote this one paragraph, the petitioner, this happens to be ITC, files this petition to request a suspension and modification of LMP such that it is not required to implement intermodal LMP and LMP to VoIP providers. Every time we state in our petition what we're requesting, it is limited to intermodal LMP and LMP to VoIP providers, VoIP providers. And in fact, in ITC's petition, we even point out that we have indeed provided intramodal LMP in the Webster and Wabe exchanges, and we're not seeking any further suspension of intramodal LMP. That's what these petitions to intervene, both MITCO and MediaCom and Sprint, address. They hold themselves out as telecommunications carriers. It's really hard to understand how we could have made it much clearer in our petition that we were not asking for that type of relief. And so I concur with Ms. Sisak's suggestions that perhaps if we can have some more dialogue with these three carriers, we would be able to somehow make it clearer, although, again, I think it's pretty clear on the face of our petitions now that they would not be affected, at least based on what they've stated in their petitions to intervene. We, on behalf of the other petitioners, I would also note that we do not object or oppose intervention of Altel, of Verizon, or of SDTA. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Talbot Wisori. Could I make a comment in response to a couple of things that have been raised?
Certainly.
First, as this proposal to try to obtain an agreement without entry, I don't see how if you deny us entry, how we can get a stipulation and order in front of you in this proceeding. It would seem to make sense to me that you would grant the interventions with the understanding that there's going to be a proposal coming from ITC and the RLX outlining what they think the scope of this is, and we can get then a stipulation. But if we're not a party, I don't know how you have a stipulation amongst the parties that's reduced to an order. So I think that procedurally makes sense, because the concern I've got is, as you listen to their explanation, they talk about VoIP providers, but they never, in their petitions, at least that I can find, are clear that they say, if you're a VoIP provider, but also a telecommunications company, then this doesn't apply. So we might be able to get over that hump, but I think to get over that hump, we need to be parties to have a stipulation and get an order that would limit the scope of any additional orders or modification or suspension.
Thank you. That answers a question that's been on my mind, is whether we just approve the others and not necessarily disapprove, but hold the others, Mid-Continent, Sprint, MediaCom, over for another day. But Mr. Gerdes is also at the microphone, and I'm anxious to hear what Ms. Weiss has to say, but please, Mr. Gerdes.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wazorik said what I was going to say, and that is I don't know how we can enter into a stipulation if we're not parties.
Okay. Thank you. I was waiting to see if Mr. Kaneki was compelled to speak to him. All right. Ms. Weiss.
Thank you. This is Roline Weiss speaking on behalf of Commission staff. Staff's position is that
I believe all the interventions should be granted at this point. I think it should be a fairly easy thing to actually come to a stipulation with the parties if I probably citing to the specific FCC rules and orders and really defining what they mean by an interconnected VoIP provider. And with respect to Ms. Sisek's concern about discovery, I just think that all those issues can be avoided by quickly coming to some sort of stipulation and then having the parties withdraw.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who has not been heard on this docket who needs to be heard? I say with trepidation. Commissioner, action? Questions, excuse me. I'm ready for action. Questions? Mr. Cole?
Yeah, I have one. Why would the allowing them to intervene and then get out be better than just deferring those three? And I understand the official law, but I was thinking that that would be a better option than to, you know, try to get paid for the taxi ride after you left the cab.
May I address that, perhaps? I think the reason, you know, if you really what Mr. Wazarek said is, in order to stipulate, certainly one could argue you got to be a party. You can't make a stipulation in a case without being a party to that case. And if that stipulation is going to resolve itself in the form of an order, you can't order somebody to do anything that's not a party to a case. So first they got to be a case, which means you've got to allow them in, and then they stipulate to get back out. But they'll get back out subject to a binding legal order that means something. I think that would be the reason.
And I guess my thought was, if we deferred it and then they just withdrew their intervention, what's to stop them from staying into the case after intervention has been granted? I mean, I have no reason to not believe that they will, but after we've granted intervention, there's no way for us to pull them out? Or could Ms. Pullman-Rogers file, say, hey, we've got this agreement with them, they still haven't refused to get out of the interview?
Well, I think at such point as their interest, if they no longer have a legitimate interest in the case, then their party status is questionable, and I believe you could conceivably...
Either side could bring up the argument.
Yes, correct. In my view. If you no longer have a bona fide interest, you don't have standing as a party. As of this point in time, I have to agree with what Mr. Wazarek said, is on its face, there's nothing in the petitions that say that the VoIP as one of the intermodal modes subject to the petition is somehow limited. You know, it doesn't say that explicitly in there. Today, Ms. Sisek and Ms. Rogers have said that, but there's nothing in the petition that really defines what the parameters are. You know, I guess we've heard here today that what that is the FCC's latest intermodal order, but, it hits me that, you know, I guess, Commissioner, it could be that on down the road, maybe the companies might, you know, depending on whether they can reach a sufficiently clear definition, for example, to make it clear that the relief requested, doesn't include them. But any number of things could happen, but just taking people on good faith, it hits me that the first step is, if they're going to reach a binding stipulation, they got to be a party first in order to do that.
Further questions, Commissioner? I was going to call you Senator Colbeck. Commissioner Colbeck? If not, Commissioner Johnson, did you have any further clarification necessary?
Sure, thank you.
I didn't quite hear you. It sounded as if...
I said no, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I heard you that time. Great. Appreciate all the discussion and information that we received here, and thank you, Ms. Weiss, for... your suggestion. I will move at this time that the
Excuse me, Commissioner, if I may, can I request permission to speak?
You can always request permission to speak, and I'll even grant it. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I've heard some comments about the petition and some disagreement as to whether or not the petition is clear on it, or the petitions are clear on their face as to the scope. I have two comments on that to make. I have represented, actually on behalf of Swiftel here, but Swiftel has represented in its opposition, or clarified, I guess, if you want to say it that way, that the petition is not intended to capture wireline to wireline LNP or obligations for LNP. And we could certainly amend our petition to make that clear if there is a outstanding question as to whether or not the current petition is clear enough on that point. But I would also like to say that the motions to intervene, other than Sprint, on their face make no representation that the entities seeking intervention are VoIP providers. The only representations concerning their status or potential status as a VoIP provider have been voiced in these comments today. With respect to Sprint, although they did in fact raise in their motion an allegation of VoIP, I think my comments pointing out their contradictory statements in other filings have addressed that and demonstrate that they are not, in fact, a VoIP provider. And that's the end of my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Sasek. And your comments are most articulate and certainly compelling. I think, frankly, from my standpoint, we're dealing with honorable persons here, and I can't imagine that the commission would sustain a process by which we felt as we pursued it that there were persons that did not have standing once they've taken a look at this. Best, at least in my opinion, that we err on the side of allowing them to go through the process, at least that very first step of the process. I will make a motion that in the matter of the petitions for suspension or modification in dockets TC08-006-78910-11-12-13-14-15-16-17-18-19-20-21-22-23-24-25-26-27, that the commission grant intervention to the parties that have filed for intervention. Seeing no discussion, is there a discussion? Excuse me. Mr. Commissioner Colbert?
Would it be in the motion that with the understanding that MidCon and Sprint and MediaCom, or do you just leave it as their intervention?
I'm just leaving it at this juncture. If you feel that there needs to be some clarification, that's fine. However, I don't know that that would be quite appropriate at this time. Further discussion? Commissioner Johnson? Excuse me.
Hey, what's that?
Calling on the vote, sir.
Yeah, no, you bet. I vote aye.
Thank you. Commissioner Colbert?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes yes, and the motion carries. Further business before the commission at this time is that we have announcements. Excuse me, that we have one other item, don't we? How shall the commission proceed? I see different people pursuing the microphone. Rolaine, excuse me, Ms. Weiss.
Thank you. At this point, I would suggest that staff get together with the parties and try to come up with a procedural schedule. The one point that I would bring up is, you know, we have this May date with regard to the temporary suspension, and I was just wondering if do any of the part, but actually you have 6 months to complete one of these suspension proceedings, and so at this point I would just ask, did any of the parties object to the suspension lasting until the August, when the 6-month timeline is up? Otherwise, I'll have to put it on the docket again.
This is Dennis Duncan for Verizon. We take the position that the 6 months would actually be too long, that 3 months would be more appropriate. That if the if you got us started on this procedural schedule, I think most of these matters are going to be resolved, and then in 3 months we ought to know whether we're going to have to our negotiations are going to be are going to come to fruition, or we have to enter into a litigation stance. So we feel Verizon feels that 6 months is too long.
6 months from now or 6 months from the first part of February?
6 months from now.
Okay, I was just talking about the going to the August deadline. But if the parties aren't going to agree on this, we can just talk about it at a procedural scheduling meeting.
If I might, Darla Rogers, I would just point out that, in fact, we've had some discussions with the wireless carriers, and I was hoping today to be able to present you with a stipulation or an agreement as to the time frame for a temporary suspension and also some parameters on when we would come back to the commission to report on how the negotiations process is proceeding. Unfortunately, we were not quite able to get all the details of that agreement put together for you today. I would tell you that I had also talked to the other interveners just to try to keep them up to speed on our negotiations with the wireless carriers, and I don't mean to speak for them, but in our last conversation late yesterday afternoon with the wireless carriers, the way we left it was we would pursue our attempts to reach a stipulation with regard to some of these time frames. And so if you would maybe give us the opportunity to pursue that, and if we are unable to come up with an agreement, then perhaps staff can help us get to that point.
This is Sean Simpson on behalf of Alta Wireless. Darla's correct. We are trying to work out a stipulation, and I think her suggestion is a good one.
No, that sounds fine, and I think we can just leave it at that, and no commission action is necessary.
Thank you. Appreciate you working out that process. We were debating whether or not Commission Council needed to convene a pre-hearing discussion. It sounds like you folks will be able to work through that process. Appreciate that. Announcements. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held April 8th, 9:30 in room 412 of the Capitol Building. Commission meetings are scheduled for April 22nd and May 6th of 2008. We appreciate all of your participation today and look forward to the next meeting. Thank you.